corrupts us all. And it has an impact on black people. It also has an impact on white lives as well. Derek Chauvin was in a system that made it seem like it might be okay to do this to somebody.
You spoke to, well, now Governor Tim Walz, who warned you the momentum to make legislative changes to reduce racial inequality might have expired. As we hit the second anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd, Robert Samuels, what is your sense?
The sense is that if you are a person of color in this country, and we talk about this in the last chapter where Tim Walz makes that comment, you cannot believe that the future is so bleak, because that would be too bleak. It could cost you your life. And so we've seen some changes on the legislative level, at the state and local level, and now we're seeing a backlash to it. The books that people were saying everyone should read in 2020 are now the books that are being banned in 2022. And when we talked with Reverend Jesse Jackson about this, he said to us, you have to consider the course of history. You have to look at the fact that progress comes in fits and starts, but people keep on moving, and we are moving toward a better place. We hope that with this book, once people can realize the context of George Floyd's life and also remember why so many people took to the streets in the name of a better tomorrow, that they might also start thinking about systemic racism and how people can see folks in a fullness that George, with a fullness and a grace that George Floyd never seemed to fully get.
Tolu, as we begin to wrap up this interview, you are a Nigerian-American journalist, the first reporter of Native African and Nigerian descent to cover the White House. You've said you felt convicted by Floyd's story. Explain what you mean as we wrap up.
Yeah, there is a common saying among people of faith, there but for the grace of God go I. And that was a refrain that was in my head as I read this story, as I learned about George Floyd, as I wrote this book, in part because I knew that I had received a number of lucky breaks in life that allowed me to have a different pathway of George Floyd. And it was clear that it was important to write this story with empathy, because any of us can experience hardship in life. Any of us can experience structural barriers in life. It's very uncommon for anyone who might be watching this to have experienced the number of hardships and structural barriers that George Floyd did, in part because that's the way systemic racism works. It operates in the background, it operates behind the scenes. And we wanted to shine a light on those systemic barriers. Even for people who have had better experiences in this country, it's important for us not to leave behind the millions of other George Floyds that are operating in silence, not getting the same attention, and who are experiencing some of the same struggles and troubles that he did during his life. And I know that as a black reporter, it's important for me to shine a light on those experiences, to make sure that people's voices are being heard, people's experiences are being seen. And George Floyd's experience is one that we hope will get people to understand that we have a lot of work to do as a country. And one of the first things we can do is acknowledge our history, acknowledge our systemic barriers, and see what we can do about fixing and changing a number of them.
Did you feel more or less hopeful when you finished your book, Tolu?
I have no choice but to feel more hopeful. That's the story of the Black American experience over the last 400 years. Hope is something that Black Americans have had to have. We've had a number of different times where we could have given up on this country. And if Black Americans were ever going to give up, we've had plenty of reasons to do so. But I
We
think
have to leave
that
it
hope.
there, but I want to thank you so much to both of you, Tolu Olorunipa and Robert Samuels.
Forrest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT. DJ Heim from Forrest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder Radio, we talk to progressive San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin, who is facing a politicized recall election on June the 7th.
Tens of millions of dollars are pouring in, used against Chesa to get rid of him, because if they can get rid of him, they can get rid of all the other progressive prosecutors across the country.
We'll also be speaking with Joe Lauria, editor-in-chief of Consortium News, which has just lost its funding through PayPal.
Is this worse than McCarthyism? Is there government involvement? What does this mean for the future of free journalism?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. 2 years ago, attorney Chesa Boudin was elected by the people of San Francisco to reform the criminal justice system in their city. He was specifically chosen to begin reversing the mass incarceration, which has been happening since the 1970s. This mass incarceration was a reaction by right-wing forces to the civil rights movement. By the time Chesa was elected, 2.3 million U.S. citizens were behind bars across the country, and another 6 million were on probation or parole. The United States has the highest per capita number of people incarcerated and under governmental supervision than any country in the world. Chesa promised to begin to reverse this outrage. As an opponent of mass incarceration, his campaign emphasized that half the people arrested in San Francisco are either addicted to drugs or mentally ill or both. He developed diversion programs. He got people into drug rehabilitation and/or psychiatric counseling. He emphasized caring not only for those arrested for crimes, but especially for their victims. He sought to and succeeded in making San Francisco a safer city. Now, after 2 years of Chesa's service, crime in San Francisco has largely decreased. As Chesa promised, his office has prosecuted police for misconduct and corporate criminals for white-collar crimes. Right-wing big money forces from outside San Francisco are attempting to recall Chesa Boudin. The vote will take place on June 7th, and early voting has already begun. Rich people who don't even live in San Francisco have played a big role in the campaign. The right-wing strategy for the recall is the use of fear. Fear of change, fear of crime, fear of minorities, fear of unsheltered people living in the streets. Chesa grew up while both of his parents, David Gilbert and Kathy Boudin, who died on May 1st, were in prison serving long terms. He was raised by friends of his parents, Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, two professors who adopted him and welcomed him into their blended family. As a young boy, he would fly alone to visit his parents and go through the prison metal detector to have a few hours with them in the visiting room. Chesa is one of a number of progressive district attorneys in the United States. The right wing understands that toppling him is critical in their effort to stop and roll back the movement for criminal justice reform. Chesa Boudin, welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
We want to ask you about when you were elected 2 years ago. What did you set out to accomplish, and how do you evaluate what you've done with respect to making San Francisco a safer place? How have you helped victims of crimes and created diversion programs?
Well, when I ran for district attorney in 2019, we put forward a very detailed, specific policy platform as part of our campaign. Robust policy papers on our website, detailed conversations with Democratic clubs and local newspapers and constituent groups. If I had to synthesize all of the different policies and programs that we promised voters we were going to implement, it would boil down essentially to a three-pronged approach. The first one is to stop using jails and prisons as a primary response to social problems, to end mass incarceration and to expand drug and mental health treatment as more effective ways to break the cycle of recidivism. The second commitment was to dramatically expand victim services. The third was to enforce laws equally, to ensure that the system of justice wasn't only working for the wealthy and well-connected, but was actually working for all of us. And over the last 2.5 years, despite the pandemic shutting down our office and our courthouses, despite drastic changes in how we live our lives, in how crimes are committed, what kinds of crimes are committed, what neighborhoods they're committed in, we have made strides to follow through on delivering in those three areas. I'll tell you a little bit about how we've done it, what we've done. We reduced the number of kids in our juvenile detention center by about 70%. We reduced the number of adults in our county jail by about 40%. And we did it by looking at each case individually, one case at a time, and raising the question, does keeping this person in jail longer promote public safety and justice? And I'll tell you one story of somebody we found in the process. We found a young woman serving her first ever jail sentence on a misdemeanor conviction, no prior convictions, who had a high-risk pregnancy. This is in the middle of the COVID pandemic. Did keeping her in jail for an extra month or two make us safer? Did it make our community safer? No, it increased the risk of a COVID outbreak in the jail. It, of course, put the baby in her womb at risk. And it wasn't going to make a meaningful difference at preventing future crime. So we got that young woman released early. We got her transported to a residential prenatal facility where she stayed sober and she gave birth to a healthy baby. And we reduced the jail population in the process. We closed a seismically unsafe jail through decisions like that one. And we saved money by closing that jail and by reducing juvenile incarceration. And that money we've invested in victim services. I presided over a historic expansion of victim services. We created 10 new victim advocate positions. When I started, we had no victim advocates whatsoever working on property crime cases. Now we've got a unit that focuses on property crime. When I started, we had a single Chinese-speaking victim advocate to serve all of San Francisco's Chinese language community. It's the second largest language group in the city after English. Now we've got five, including the first ever head of victim services, who's Chinese American. Language access is so critical. And you know, in the third category, we've created units like our worker protection unit that make sure billionaires in their boardrooms are not able to violate the law with impunity. We've expanded and strengthened the work we do around police accountability, filing the first ever homicide charges against San Francisco Police Department officers who shot and killed an unarmed Black man while on duty. Now, there's a lot more I'd like to say, and I hope we'll have time to say about the work we've done in each of these areas, but let me wrap up my answer to your question with this. You asked about public safety. Now, I know that San Franciscans, many San Franciscans, do not feel safe. I know that there's been an exponential increase in media coverage of crime and videos of crimes being committed going viral on social media and apps like Nextdoor and Twitter. We have to respond to the way that people feel, and we need, and my job and my commitment is to make everybody in San Francisco safe and feel safe. We also have to make policy based on the data that we see. And we need to remember that what we experience on the streets and what big picture data shows us may not always be in sync. Overall, in the 2.5 years I've been in office, there have been about 28,000 fewer reported crimes than there were in San Francisco in the 2.5 years prior to my administration. So yes, we are safer as a city. We are doing better than supposedly tough on crime jurisdictions like Oakland and Sacramento, where crime rates have skyrocketed over the last couple of years. We have our challenges. We are continuing to fight to make our city safer, to have more effective ways to hold people who commit crimes accountable, and to ensure that everybody is safe in their home, in their neighborhood, and everywhere in our city. And yes, I am proud of the work my team has done during a historically challenging 2 years.
Chesa, please talk about what's wrong with cash bail and what you've done to reform the situation.
Cash bail is a system that's really unique to the United States and the Philippines. It's a for-profit system where anyone who's arrested can buy their way out of jail without regard to how dangerous they are. It's a system that both undermines public safety by allowing wealthy people who are very dangerous to buy their freedom. And it's a system that undermines equal protection under law by depriving people who are presumed innocent of their liberty simply based on poverty. When I took office, one of my very first policies was to prohibit my assistant district attorneys from ever using money bail as a basis to detain someone in custody. We replaced a wealth-based system of pretrial incarceration with a risk-based system of pretrial incarceration. And if you think about it, it's logical. If we look at someone we've just charged, say with attempted murder, a serious violent crime, and we believe that they're the kind of person who might go out and try to complete the murder, to finish the job, I don't care if they're a billionaire. We should ask the court to hold them in custody pending trial. Public safety demands it. Protecting victims requires it. Let's take another example. If someone is arrested for shoplifting and they have no prior criminal history and they're desperate and they're poor, we should not put a price tag on their freedom. They're presumed innocent. They present a low risk to public safety. And the court should release them on whatever non-monetary conditions can reasonably assure they come back to court to face charges. That's what the Constitution requires. That's what our values as a society require, and that's what public safety requires. And I'm proud that San Francisco was the first jurisdiction in the country where the district attorney's office decided across the board that we're going to use risk, not wealth, to determine which people, pending trial, presumed innocent, that we are accusing of crimes, we will ask the court to hold in jail.
You've reduced sentences for 68 people. How did that promote safety and justice?
We created a post-conviction unit that looked at old cases, some of them 40 plus years old, where people were still in prison. And what we tried to do in those cases was two things. First of all, evaluate whether or not the person would have received a less severe sentence under today's standards, today's norms, today's legal sentencing guidelines. And second, we tried to evaluate whether that person could safely be released. And we did that in conversation with the victims' families. We did that in conversation with reentry partners and with the courts. And after carefully evaluating the prison record and the case file in each of these cases. And what we found was shocking. I mean, I can tell you a few stories. We found a woman who was prosecuted as an adult, even though she was a juvenile, for playing a relatively minor role in a very serious crime. She was prosecuted as an adult. She was sentenced to life in prison, and she had served about 40 years. When we identified her case, we saw that she had a strong reentry plan. We saw that she was safe to come back to her community. We asked the court to consider resentencing her. And the case was sent back to the same judge who had made the decision 40 years ago to have her tried as an adult. He's still on the bench. He's still hearing cases. And when the case came before him, he apologized to that woman. He apologized because he recognized, as we all do, that our standards have changed. That today, for her role in the crime, as a minor, as a juvenile, she never would have been given that life sentence. It makes us safer because it restores trust and integrity in the work we do every day securing new convictions. It makes us safer because it reduces the strain on our overcrowded prisons and jails and frees up resources for those folks who truly need to be incarcerated. It makes us safer because it allows people who have been in and who have demonstrated not only that they have been rehabilitated, that they've grown and changed, that they're no longer the same person who committed a serious crime. It allows those people to come back and play productive roles in our society, in their families, in their communities. And many of these folks who we've brought home are now doing critical work, mentoring young people, violence interruption work, helping to safeguard our communities, helping to de-escalate fights or beefs that could escalate into violence. We need folks with credibility, with lived experience. We need folks who've learned the lesson the hard way to help the next generation avoid making those kinds of mistakes.
Chesa, there's a lot of money that's being used to organize against you. For example, there's a billionaire named William Oberndorf who technically lives in San Francisco, though he's moving all of his money through a dark money pack that's based out of town, and other billionaire supporters that do not live in San Francisco at all. What kind of money has been donated to recall you, and what is the connection between Mitch McConnell, and why is that important? You've written that there's a direct line between the recall effort and the GOP's plan to overturn Roe versus Wade. Please explain.
The biggest single donor to the recall effort against me, individual named William Oberndorf, he's given more than $650,000, and he's moved it, as have many other wealthy individuals, through a out-of-town dark money pack called Neighbors for a Better San Francisco. That pack has moved more than $3.3 million into the recall committee. They're doing it that way so that they can hide the identity of all the other donors. They're doing it that way so they can give the money not as cash, but as stock to avoid paying capital gains. They're doing it that way because they don't want San Francisco voters to know that this recall is being financed by Republicans. Republicans like Oberndorf, who are responsible for destroying this country. Let me tell you what I mean. Oberndorf didn't only donate $650,000 to have me recalled. He gave Mitch McConnell's committee more than $6 million over the last several years, money that was used to try and take control of the Senate for the Republicans, that was effective for a number of years in allowing the Senate Republicans to pack the U.S. Supreme Court. They have a radical right-wing agenda. These people are oligarchs who are disconnected from the challenges of daily life for most residents of cities like San Francisco. These are people whose vision on public safety includes things like the death penalty, deporting our immigrant neighbors, trying juveniles as adults, undermining women's right to control their own bodies, attacking voting rights, weakening gun control laws. These are people whose views are totally out of touch with San Francisco and with evidence-based policies that promote public safety. And the recall committee wants to pretend that it is a Democrat-led committee. Let's be clear, the San Francisco Democratic Party has opposed this recall. The San Francisco Republican Party has tweeted its support for the recall, as have senators like Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton, the very kinds of people that the billionaire donors supporting this recall are backing with their money.
We are talking today to progressive prosecutor Chesa Boudin, who is facing a very politicized recall election on June the 7th. Chesa, what's at stake not only for you, but the other progressive prosecutors like Kim Fox in Chicago, Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, and George Gascon in Los Angeles?
The police unions and their Republican allies are losing. They're losing elections in cities and counties across this country because voters are sick and tired of failed tough-on-crime approaches that don't rehabilitate, that ignore victims' needs and rights, and that bankrupt local governments, starving them of the resources needed to invest in healthcare and housing and education and employment, things that actually prevent crime and make safe, vibrant communities. They've realized that they can't beat us in elections where we actually talk about ideas, where we actually put forward our platforms and achievements and track records. And so instead of waiting until 2023 when I'm up for re-election next year. They're trying to recall me in a race where they don't have to put their views on the table. They can spend unlimited money, no contribution limits. They can do it while cheating on taxes and avoiding paying capital gains taxes on their stock. And they can do it in ways that allow them to do nothing other than attack and undermine and manipulate and lie and spread misinformation about the work we are doing. It's a playbook. It's not limited to San Francisco. Across the country, they are attacking progressive prosecutors who are trying to fix a badly, badly dysfunctional system. We see them spreading fear, exploiting tragedy, propping up straw man arguments, manipulating, spreading confusion about how the system works, about what role the police play and what role prosecutors play. And we see them not only trying to recall me in San Francisco, but also D.A. Gascon in Los Angeles. And if you have any doubt about the fact that this is a nationwide playbook, you don't need to look any further than Illinois, where a conservative assembly member in the state legislature introduced a bill that, if passed, would allow Illinois residents to recall District Attorney Kim Fox in Chicago. Only her, no other district attorney in the state, would be subject to recall. I mean, it is preposterous. It's dishonest. It's undemocratic. And it's a playbook. And it's well-funded, and it's well-orchestrated, and they have a tremendous amount of access to local and national media outlets to spread lies and misinformation. We've got to push back. We've got to stand up not only for the evidence-based policies that we're implementing, things like protecting the privacy of sexual assault survivors so their DNA isn't used against them, things like ensuring that victims of domestic violence have safe shelters to go to. Policies we've implemented in my office are under attack because these folks only want to use victims as pieces of evidence to secure convictions and to impose lengthy prison sentences. We need to stand up for these policies, and we need to stand up for voters' right to choose who represents them, who serves as their district attorney. It should not be up to the billionaire oligarchs to undo the will of the voters.
Chase Boudin, what's the significance of Ted Cruz and Tucker Carlson coming out against you?
It shows very clearly that while there may be some Democrats, there may be many Democrats in San Francisco who support the recall, we know who's behind it. We know what the talking points are. We know where the money comes from. We know which media interests are driving the fear that leads even some Democrats to think a recall will make them safer when it will not. Those folks, Tucker Carlson, Ted Cruz, Tom Cotton, the ultra-right wing, the leadership of the far-right wing of the Republican Party in this country, need to use people like me and cities like San Francisco as examples of what happens when you elect progressives. They need to scare people in places like Oklahoma and Texas and Arkansas into continuing to vote for failed Republican candidates and failed Republican policies. And they do that through dishonestly suggesting that one neighborhood in San Francisco, the Tenderloin, represents the entire city. They do that by suggesting that somehow every city in America doesn't have drug use or crime. The reality is, if you look at red jurisdictions with conservative Republican prosecutors, their crime rates have gone up more in the last 2 years than jurisdictions with folks like me who are trying to implement reform. But you'll never hear about that from Ted Cruz. You'll never hear about that on Fox News. They have an agenda, and their agenda is to make people who've never been to San Francisco, who don't know the city that I call home, feel like some kind of post-apocalyptic dystopia. We have our challenges with public safety, with housing, with mental illness, with crime. Of course we do, like any city. But if you look at the data, and I know the data doesn't mean much if you yourself have been a victim of crime. That's why we're investing so much in supporting crime victims. And we're looking at data and big picture trends and implementing policies based on evidence. And if you look at the evidence, crime is down in San Francisco compared to neighboring jurisdictions. Crime is at or near historic lows, both violent crime and property crime, despite the fact that property crime is way too high here. We are doing better than the tough-on-crime jurisdictions that Tucker Carlson and Ted Cruz lift up as examples. It's dishonest, it's manipulative, and they have an agenda that is at odds with the best interests of people, not just in San Francisco, but across this country.
Chesa, what kind of support are you getting and from whom?
I'm so humbled by the broad coalition of support that we've been able to build in the campaign against this recall. The San Francisco Democratic Party almost unanimously opposed this recall. The ACLU of Northern California, the Sierra Club, the Green Party. And when it comes to our local media outlets, the San Francisco Chronicle, the San Francisco Examiner, the Bay Area Reporter, and Tsingtao Daily, the biggest Chinese language outlet, all have come out opposing this recall, as has the San Francisco Labor Council and individual labor unions that represent our nurses and our public school teachers and our in-home healthcare workers, the union that represents my victim advocates, all across San Francisco, our Democratic clubs, our community organizations, and our community leaders, elected officials, the majority of our board of supervisors, more than a dozen retired judges with over 200 years of experience on the bench, including a California retired Supreme Court justice, have come out and said this recall will not make you safer. Reject the Republican-funded recall. It's humbling. It's inspiring. And I know that with this coalition behind me, if we fight hard for these last couple of weeks, we're going to win. And we're going to continue to make changes that are long overdue, changes that will put the justice back in the criminal justice system.
So, Chesa, how can listeners get in touch with you and your campaign, and what can we do to help you?
Well, we'd love to have people get involved in these last couple of weeks. We are in the home stretch. The election is June 7th. We've got a couple different websites. You can go online and learn more at chesaboudin.com. That's C-H-E-S-A-B-O-U-D-I-N.com. You can donate there. Obviously, every dollar counts. We are being massively outspent by the Republican billionaires, so donations are always helpful. The other thing is we want people to volunteer. We're doing phone banks. We had John Legend show up at one of our Zoom phone bank sessions just yesterday. So join us for a phone bank. I can't promise John Legend will be back when you show up, but you can go to stoptherepublicancon.com and learn more about our supporters, ways to donate, ways to volunteer. Either one of those websites is a great way to learn about our work, to donate, or to get involved in volunteering from wherever you are. You can join us for phone banking and text banking from wherever you call home. And we're so appreciative of your support. This is a national movement. It's not a moment. It's a national movement, and we want you to be part of it.
Chesa Boudin, on behalf of Marjorie Cohn and myself, we're so grateful for your great work. You're one of us, and we're with you all the way. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Great speaking with you, and I look forward to coming back again soon and talking about lessons learned once we're on the other side of this recall.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
PayPal, YouTube, and Facebook are quashing non-mainstream reporting and opinion about the war in Ukraine. Alternative media is in danger of even more extensive suppression. Archival videos of Chris Hedges' RT show, On Contact, were removed from YouTube after RT was banned. This included two interviews Hedges did with me, Michael Smith, the co-host of Law & Disorder Radio. One of them was about Donald Trump. The other covered Law & Disorder Radio founder Michael Ratner's memoir. Consortium News, founded by veteran journalist Robert Perry in 1995 and currently run by Joe Loria, was banned by PayPal in May. This was also done to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks years ago after they revealed U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Consortium News apparently offended the big tech company, possibly with U.S. government connivance, by being critical of U.S. policy in Ukraine. PayPal will not reveal its reasons for the ban.
Specifically, Consortium News wrote about NATO's eastward expansion, as well as the U.S. role in the violence in the 2014 Maidan Square overthrow of the democratically elected government of Ukraine and replacing it with one more friendly to the United States. According to Loria, Consortium News has about 10,000 listeners a day. Sometimes this spikes to 40,000. Their PayPal account has allowed listeners to click on a support button and thus conveniently give money to the organization. PayPal recently informed Joe Loria that Consortium News has been permanently banned. It would not discuss why. Are we facing a dystopian future of big tech and government suppression of alternative journalism? Journalist Matt Tybee has written that, quote, going after cash is a big jump from simply deleting speech, with a much bigger chilling effect, end quote. This, he added, is, quote, especially true for the alternative media world where money has been notoriously tight. We speak today with Consortium News Editor-in-Chief Joe Loria. He's a former UN correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, Boston Globe, and numerous other newspapers, including the Montreal Gazette and the Star of Johannesburg. He was an investigative reporter for the Sunday Times of London and began his professional work as a 19-year-old stringer for the New York Times.
Joe Loria, editor-in-chief of Consortium News, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Marjorie and Michael.
Joe, what is Consortium News? What is your mission and who reads it?
Consortium News was begun in 1995 was the earliest news website on the independent news site in the United States in 1995, begun by Robert Parry, who was, of course, a premier investigative journalist in his day for the Associated Press. He broke some of the biggest Iran-Contra stories, including naming Oliver North and his role. Unfortunately, the AP kept spiking that story. They didn't want to run it. And eventually went out by mistake on the Spanish wire, and that was too late for AP, so they had to obviously publish it also in English. Had that not happened, we may never have learned about Oliver North, or at least not when we did. So Bob went, kind of got fed up at AP and went on to Newsweek, where once again his corporate editors were spiking stories critical of U.S. foreign policy. He was once told by a senior editor that something he wanted to run was not for the good of the country. Of course, not good for the good of the elites running the country, not for the people of the country. So that was the last straw for Bob. And in 1995, as I say, he began a website called Consortium News, or The Consortium originally. And Salon.com went online actually 5 days after Consortium News did. We went online November 15, 1995, which is our 27th year. The New York Times and the LA Times and the Washington Post, etc., their websites went up a couple of months later. So it is from ancient history in terms of the internet. And what is really the mission of Consortium News, the essential mission is to publish crucial facts that are purposely omitted from, and sometimes deceptively, from corporate news stories, or to take angles that are also not being followed by the mainstream media. In other words, the stories that Bob's editors spiked, and my editors at the Wall Street Journal, I joined in, started writing for Consortium News in 2011 while still working as a contract reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and they were suppressing some of my stories. So I approached Bob Parry then, and he gladly published my very first article about that. I was based at the United Nations for 25 years for many big papers, including the Boston Globe. And the journal was suppressing the information, not the whole story, but part of it, where I was writing about the Palestinian move to become recognized as an observer state at the General Assembly. And I kept mentioning that 135 or so countries had already recognized Palestine as a state, and that they had, some of them had even exchanged ambassadors. And that was kept being cut out of my story. I thought it was crucial to understand how the vote would go in the General Assembly. So I wrote that piece for Bob. So our mission has been from the beginning to again, write what is being cut out of the mainstream media, which completely changes the story. We'll get to Ukraine in a moment. The same thing's happening here in a big way, which is related to PayPal and all the other things that are happening. And Consortium News was in the forefront and correct on numerous major stories, such as the invasion of Iraq, opposing the invasion, saying that the WMD were not to be found. Russiagate, Bob Parry was way out ahead of that before anyone else debunking that story. And of course, also on Ukraine, writing in 2014 in real time about things everyone knows about now, about the neo-Nazis, about the coup, although the mainstream media denies there was a coup or that the neo-Nazis are a big problem. In Ukraine, about the civil war against Donbass, and Bob Perry even wrote in 2015 a story about possible nuclear war in Ukraine over this crisis that the United States had created. I thought at the time he was going a little bit over the top, but now, in light of everything we know in the last couple of months, we are closer to a nuclear war perhaps than any time, certainly since the Cuban Missile Crisis. So he was way out ahead of that. And he was not over the top. He was absolutely spot on. So Bob Perry was a legendary reporter with an enormous capacity for work. He did it almost all himself. He died in 2018, January. I became editor-in-chief in April of 2018. I've been running it ever since. I understand better than anybody just how much work Bob Perry did. I've hired a deputy editor and a video producer. We started CN Live, a webcast. So we've been able to expand. Our funding has gone up dramatically. We just on Friday, passed 50,000 Twitter followers. It was at 16 when Bob left us. So we've had a bigger presence online, and we've been able to expand, and our funding is larger than it ever was before. A lot of that is fueled by what we're going to talk about in this interview about PayPal. There's been an enormous response to us. Our writers have come out of the mainstream, by the way. Our deputy editor was a Wall Street Journal editor. One of our columnists was Asia editor of International Herald Tribune. I bring that up to show that we come from the inside. We've had former CIA officers writing for us, like John Kiriakou does. We come from the establishment. We're not citizen journalists or amateurs. We're professional journalists or intelligence professionals that have been on the inside, and we can present a unique understanding of what is the establishment is doing based on our experience and our critique. And I think that makes Consortium News very special, unlike other alternative news websites.
Joe, who's your readership? Who reads Consortium News, and how is Consortium News funded?
Our readership was around 10,000 a day, and it spiked after the Russian invasion to as much as 45,000 a day. Our analytics showed that it's still a largely older audience, mostly male, although that has changed. Average age has dropped in the last few years, and there are more women reading it. We know that who our funders are, and they are overwhelmingly our readers, and they come from mostly in the United States. But we have readers in Australia, Canada, and Britain, the other English-speaking countries, and we get donors from there as well, but also in Germany and Scandinavia and France. We're read mostly around the world, but the vast majority are Americans of over 55, but not, as I say, as high as before. So our funding, we do 3 fundraisers a year publicly. People can donate, used to be able to donate through PayPal. They could donate by credit card or check. And you don't have to pay a penny to read Consortium News. It's totally free. We've never taken a penny from an advertiser, from any corporation or any government. And the government has never given us a cent. We are there to criticize governments, all governments. And we have just hired a outside auditor who's going to make a study of our books and come up with an audit statement to show that a government or a corporation or an advertiser has never given money to Consortium News. We will list our major funders over $5,000 by their country of residence without naming who these people are. But our 2 major funders that we have made public are Roger Waters, the rock artist of Pink Floyd fame, and the Cloud Mountain Foundation, which funds a lot of left-of-center media organizations, but they've given each $25,000 stretch over the last couple of years. This is based on our last tax returns of 2021. Sorry, I should say 2020. We have not done the 2021 yet, but these are our major donors, those 2, and many people give us $250 or $500, occasionally $1,000. And after this incident with PayPal, we were flooded with donations like we never saw in one day before. So we have a lot of support around the world, but we're not a large or major news organization. Obviously, we don't have the kind of reach that mainstream media does, but we have a loyal readership that depends on a different point of view. Like I was explaining at the beginning, that leaves out, we provide what a lot is left out of the mainstream media. And I think people want to hear that.
2 weeks ago in May, Consortium News was banned permanently from receiving funds via PayPal. Please tell us what happened.
Well, it came out of the blue, Marjorie. We got an email from PayPal, and it wasn't even written specifically to us. There was just an image of the statement, and the statement said that we were permanently limited, which in their language means permanently suspended, banned, and that whatever money we had in the account, which was slightly less than $10,000, was going to be held on to by PayPal, and they gave no reason why. They just said we were banned and they're going to hold on to our money. Well, I looked into their user agreement, various other statements from them on their website, and I called and spoke to actually two customer service agents, and I learned that they would hold on to that money until they determined whether whatever we had done wrong would implicate them in damages. And if they had to pay any damages, then they were going to just keep our money. And that decision would be made by them in total secret without any due process whatsoever, basically to award themselves damages as if they were a judge or a jury, and we had no input on that. They were holding on to our money, and they never explained why. And even speaking to those two people, they would not tell me, and they didn't know. The second person said, the account is in Consortium News, but the administrator's name was still Robert Perry. She said she would only speak to him. I informed her that he was deceased for 4 years. Well, then she couldn't tell me anything. Well, this happened to Mint Press News as well. And Minar Adli, who's the editor there and whose name is the administrator on the account, she called them and asked, and they wouldn't tell her either. So they're not telling anyone dead or alive why they have shut down Consortium News and Mint Press permanently. They also shut down her personal account and that of an associate editor there as well. Unfortunately, they've not gone after my personal PayPal account, although I removed all the money I had in it, and no one else from Consortium News. A couple of days later, after we published this story, and as Matt Taibbi wrote a big piece on his Substack, and the New York Post picked up on that in a brief editorial, they didn't name us in Mint Press, but they referred to Matt Taibbi's column, that we suddenly got our money back. And I think it may have had to do with the fact that we would have no legal recourse against them if they want to shut us down. But if they held on to our money, we would. In fact, there is in Northern California a class action suit against PayPal for exactly the same things that were done to those plaintiffs as was done to us. That money was held on to, including a poker champion who put out a tweet saying that they're holding on to his money. They didn't tell him why they shut his account down, and he was inviting anyone on Twitter to join, if it had happened to them, to join his class action suit. Suddenly, I think the next day, they returned the money that they were holding from him. So I suspect, although I don't know, and the fact is we're left with assumptions here, that our money was returned to prevent us from taking any action. It wasn't worth $9,000 to PayPal. And we got it back within 3 days of them shutting us down. However, even though an email informed us that we now could try to get our suspension lifted, we were then informed after I called that that was a mistake. They sent us the wrong email. And in fact, we're shut down permanently forever. So we cannot use PayPal to raise funds to pay our writers. I think this is clearly an attempt to defund Consortium News. We have other ways to donate, but that was an important way. I think that there's evidence why they did this. In their user agreement, they say that we cannot provide them or a third party, which could be the public, with false or misleading information. And the only thing we trade in is information. We don't sell drug paraphernalia or guns, which is banned on PayPal. We just trade in information. And what other reason could there have been except they didn't like our information, particularly about in the timing with the Ukraine war? So I do think that's why PayPal shut us down. If it were a non-controversial reason, why wouldn't they say it? They're not saying this because it would be embarrassing. Even if they have a legal right to do that, it's clearly against the spirit of the First Amendment, of free speech, of free press, and they just don't want to have that problem. So they're not telling us, and we could only make a very good educated guess that it had to do with us providing false information in their opinion.
Joe, our own founder of Law and Disorder, Michael Ratner, was representing Julian Assange and WikiLeaks when they were banned from receiving PayPal funds. Do you see any parallels between that case and yours?
Well, some. There's a lot of differences, though. And I should mention that I'm here in London, and two nights ago I was at an event, at a cinema screening of a film called Hacking Justice, which is probably the best film made about Julian Assange's case. And on the stage was Stella Assange, Julian's wife, and she mentioned PayPal and the fact that they've shut down Consortium News and Mint Press News, and how disturbing that was. And she made reference to what had happened to WikiLeaks. That was back in 2010. First of all, WikiLeaks is a lot larger than we are, obviously, and a lot more influential. And they also have deep pockets, or deeper than we do anyway, and they were able to get legal representation, and they actually won in the end. They were able to get PayPal to reverse its decision to shut down WikiLeaks. The clear reason there had to be, again, to defund WikiLeaks, to shut down its operations, as I believe PayPal is trying to do to us. And the other thing that happened to WikiLeaks that hasn't happened to us, and hopefully will not, is that MasterCard and Visa also shut down WikiLeaks. That was also a court victory for WikiLeaks. They were able to reverse that ban. So there was a coordinated effort to shut down WikiLeaks' funding. And this is a very, very obviously troubling development that fortunately WikiLeaks won. We are not going to sue, as I explained just earlier. But I think there's a parallel there. And what's scary is that while WikiLeaks was a major publication and it caused major problems to the U.S. government and other governments, Consortium News is really a small player. And this is what's troubling to me, that in this current environment of the Ukraine war and this enforcement of a single narrative and the pressure to give in to that, where they want a total control, it seems, over what the story is. And the word total is in totalitarian. And I used to hesitate to say that, but I don't right now. But I think they're trying to stamp out the slightest spark of dissent, as small as we are, lest it grows into some kind of conflagration, and that will give them even more troubles. And the process of censorship now is very different than it was in the past. I could speak about that later. And I think that they want to shut down even small players like us, whereas before it was WikiLeaks 10 years ago. And that's a big change that we're seeing right now, and I think that's really, really disturbing.
Joe, do you think the U.S. government had anything to do with the ban? The Department of Homeland Security has an office devoted to what they call the Disinformation Board, although it's recently been suspended.
Yeah, well, it's obviously impossible to answer that question. We have no idea whether there was any communication between that now suspended board and PayPal or anybody else in the U.S. government, like the State Department. I just don't know that. But I will say this, that previous to that Homeland Security Disinformation Governance Board, the U.S. government was working indirectly to censor, I'll use the C word, to censor websites, news organizations that were not towing the U.S. government line. And they went indirectly to the major social media companies, and we saw it play out in public in numerous congressional hearings in which the CEOs of Google, Facebook, Twitter were grilled by mostly Democratic lawmakers and really pressured to shut down what they call fake news or disinformation. So that was a indirect way, as of course the First Amendment prevents Congress from passing any law to prevent free speech or free press, but they were trying to do it by proxy through these social media companies, which apparently is also could be illegal. And Marjorie, you're the lawyer, you might be able to cite the Supreme Court decision where the government cannot use someone else to do something that the government itself cannot do. But we've now moved with this Disinformation Governance Board, and it's very heartening that it was put on hold because of the fierce reaction against it, that they were doing directly a direct government censorship operation. And, you know, Woodrow Wilson in 1917 tried to get direct official government censorship into the 1917 Espionage Act, and he lost by one vote in the Senate. He was unable to get that. And the press at the time opposed him mostly. But, of course, he came the next year with the Alien and Sedition Act, which basically did the same thing. And as we know, Eugene Debs, a Socialist Party leader, and hundreds of other people were thrown in jail for speeches they made, just for speech, mostly advocating against the military draft for First World War. So this would have been with this disinformation governance board, if it comes back, although I don't think it will. Let's hope it doesn't. This would be what Woodrow Wilson was asking for, in essence, which is government censorship in peacetime. The United States is not at war right now, although it seems that way. The rhetoric, the propaganda, the pressure is reminiscent of the weeks and months before the invasion of Iraq in 2003, maybe even more hysterical than that. But it's peacetime, and even during World War II, editors were relied upon to self-censor. The government did not really censor government. It happened during the Civil War with Abraham Lincoln. Some newspapers were shut down in the North. But this didn't really happen in World War II. It started in Korea because there was stories and photographs of dead American soldiers, and General MacArthur then started to order direct government censorship, because the system of self-censorship had broken down. But mostly there has not been a government system in peacetime, there's never been really, of censorship until this governance board of disinformation. And this is a very frightening development, and it's happening in the under the cover of this of the Ukraine war, and because of it, I think. And I think that's related to PayPal, even though PayPal, we have no idea whether the government was involved. I think they could think the same way as the government does about this, and they can act on their own. And they also have a relationship with the Anti-Defamation League. And that, I think, had something probably to do with it as well.
We did want to ask you about the Anti-Defamation League. I want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Joe Loria, who's the editor-in-chief of Consortium News. They've been banned by PayPal. Joe, do you think the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, may have played a role in connection with PayPal's ban on Consortium News? The ADL calls itself a civil rights organization, but a person that we respect, Donna Neville, a leader of the Jewish Voices for Peace, calls the ADL a Zionist propaganda organization. What do you think the ADL had to do with this, if anything?
The British government just put sanctions on an Irish journalist who worked for RT, and they said that because he was endangering the Ukrainian people because of the reporting that he did for RT. So again, I'm just guessing here about what the ADL's role may have been, but they do have this formal relationship that was announced with PayPal. Again, either they acted on their own, the PayPal executive, or in collaboration with the ADL to shut down Mint Press News and us. There's only guesswork there, but we know what their position is. Certainly on Israel, as you pointed out, but it could extend to the war in Ukraine as well. They just won't say. But the point is, we were shut down at a time when we were simply trying to report the causes of the war in Ukraine. We're not supporting the invasion. We're not supporting either side. And this, our role as journalists, is to try to examine and explain what the causes of this huge crisis is. And if you look back in history, historians will say that the onerous conditions put on Germany at the Versailles Peace Conference after World War I led to the rise of Nazism and to World War II in terms of the resentment it caused in Germany. So nobody is accusing those historians of excusing what Nazi Germany did, but they're simply trying to explain that. So when we talk about the expansion of NATO, despite a promise made to Russia not to do so in 1990, into Eastern Europe, when we talk about clear evidence of a U.S. coup in 2014 to put a pro-Western leader in the leadership of Ukraine and overthrow a democratically elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, certified by the OSCE, his election was, because he'd simply chosen a Russian deal over the European Union Association Agreement. When we talk about the treaty proposals that Russia offered in December to NATO and the United States to create a new security architecture in Europe, and Russia was requesting that forward deployments of NATO troops from Eastern European members of NATO be withdrawn. Those countries could remain in NATO, but they didn't want those troops nearer to their borders, and missiles that were both defensive and offensive in nature would be to be removed from Poland and Romania. And the United States and NATO completely rejected that out of hand. There was never any negotiation. So there were reasons why this happened, and we need to be able to publish what those reasons are. And I think that there's a great objection to that. We have this organization, NewsGuard, that is a private company based in New York, that has on its board Michael Hayden, who is former NSA CIA director, a former NATO secretary general, former Pennsylvania governor. He is on the board. They have partnerships with the Pentagon and with the State Department. Although NewsGuard says that the members of the board have no role in reviewing news organizations, they're certainly there in an advisory capacity. So there are links to former government officials there, and they have approached us, and they're reviewing us, and they want us to correct stories about Ukraine in particular, about us reporting there was a coup in 2014, and us reporting that Nazism, neo-Nazism, has a very influential role in Ukraine from the 2014 coup until today. They object to that, and I'm in the process of responding and should publish an article in a couple of days and respond to them, in which essentially I'm turning the tables on them, because while they say we need to correct our stories, I believe strongly that they need to correct their stories. For example, in their writings on the 2014 events, they simply leave out the leaked conversation between Assistant Secretary of State at the time, Victoria Nuland, and the American Ambassador, Jeffrey Piot. That was back in 2014, American Ambassador in Ukraine, in which they are discussing the leaders who would take over after an unconstitutional change of government in Kiev. And that was completely left out of NewsGuard's reporting on this. And that's exactly why Consortium News was created, to publish what corporate media suppresses. And when you do that, the whole story changes. When you take out all of these elements of the causes, that doesn't mean, again, you support what Russia did. I wrote on February 4th, 20 days before the invasion, that the U.S. was setting a trap for Russia because otherwise they could not launch the incredibly strong economic sanctions, economic war, the information war, which is what we're talking about today, as well as the proxy war. And just this week, $40 billion was passed by both houses and about to be signed or signed by now by Joe Biden to give this kind of military and other aid to Ukraine. This is the proxy war, to keep that war going, to bleed Russia, as the Secretary of Defense said, to weaken Russia. And as Joe Biden said several times now, that the aim is to overthrow Putin. He said it outright in Poland in his speech, but he said it on the day of the invasion in his press conference, that when he was asked why would the sanctions have any effect now when they did nothing to prevent the invasion, he responded it was the sanctions was never intended to prevent the invasion. It was to show the Russian people what he did, Vladimir Putin, and to have the Russian people essentially rise up against him. This is the end game. This is what the U.S. has wanted for a long time in Ukraine.
Joe, unfortunately, we've come to an end of our allotted time. Before we let you go, very, very briefly, could you please tell us how people can be in touch with Consortium News and come to your support?
Yes, thank you. Consortiumnews.com, one word. And at the very top right-hand corner, you'll see a red donate button. Please press on that. You can make a credit card donation, or you can send us a check. The address is there. You cannot, unfortunately, any longer donate through PayPal. Thanks very much for having me on, Michael and Marjorie.
This is truly a scary situation, worse than McCarthyism in some people's opinion, and we're so grateful for the good work you do. Thank you, Joe Loria. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you again.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org, one word, lawanddisorder.org.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. For information, call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Very often what happens in discussions of the Holocaust is a shortcut is taken. One says, well, it was all about anti-Semitism, and one refers to Hitler. Fine, but that actually isn't the answer. That's the question. The answer to the question of how the Holocaust happened is not anti-Semitism. That's only part of the question. We have to work our way from that radical view into German politics, into human sensibilities, and then beyond Germany.
That's Timothy Snyder, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Timothy Snyder on the Holocaust. Where does one start when talking about the Holocaust? The word derives from the Greek, a burnt offering, a sacrifice by fire. It is one of the greatest crimes in human history, and we are cautioned to learn the lessons of the Holocaust. Historian Timothy Snyder argues that the history that we might understand is rather different than the history that we generally remember, and that if we did it right, the lessons that we draw from the present and the future would be different lessons than the ones we draw now. And that's important, Snyder says, because whether we like it or not, we are already drawing lessons from the Holocaust. We do it all the time. But what if we understand the Holocaust incompletely or even incorrectly? Then we've drawn the wrong lessons, and we may be accelerating disaster rather than preventing it. Our guest today is Timothy Snyder. He's Richard C. Levin Professor of History at Yale University and a permanent fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, Austria. He's the author of Black Earth, On Tyranny, and Our Melody. This classic program was recorded at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, in 2015. We air it to mark Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial Day. And now, Timothy Snyder.
It is a commonplace that in order to understand the Holocaust, one must begin with Hitler. But returning to the primary sources, rereading Mein Kampf, rereading the second book, rereading the speeches, the addresses, I noticed a coherence, a total quality to the ideas, which I hadn't noticed before, and which I think perhaps eludes us in general. And I'd like to begin with that. I'd like to begin with a short summary of what Hitler's anti-Semitism actually was. And this is important, because when one considers Hitler's anti-Semitism, it's not just a matter of someone being more anti-Semitic than other people, right? It's not just a transitive issue. This person is more anti-Semitic, this is more anti-Semitic, this is more anti-Semitic. It's not like that. There are qualitative differences in the kinds of anti-Semitism that people believe in, that people work from. And in Hitler's case, what we have is what I would think of as a planetary anti-Semitism, a chain of reasoning at the end of which there's only one possible conclusion, and that is the eradication of the Jews. Hitler starts from the premise that we as human beings are races, that races are like species, and what species do is compete for land and food so they can propagate. He takes that as being the only true thing about the world. It's a law of nature, he says in Mein Kampf, like a law of physics. It's as certain, he says, as the law of gravity. Why might we think otherwise? Why might we be under the impression that friendship or love or marriage or law or the state or a political party or any other commitment to human reciprocity exists, has weight, matters, or should matter? Why might we think such things? The answer, Hitler says, is the Jews. The Jews are responsible, and this is the radical character of Hitler's claim, the Jews are responsible for every idea of human reciprocity which distracts us from racial solidarity. From Hitler's point of view, all we should be doing is recognizing who belongs to our race and who does not, and fighting on behalf of our race against everyone else, taking land from everyone else, starving them to death, propagating on what had been their territory. That is all we should be doing. Any intellectual distraction from that, says Hitler, is Jewish. Any